but each groove glistened with some kind of liquid. Oil? Taken together, these things made me deeply uncomfortable, and Frank kept retreating farther into the tunnel, luring Caligula to follow. Apparently, Caligula's lieutenant, Gregorix, was also getting worried. The Germanus shouted from the front lines,
"My emperor, you're getting too far!"
"Shut up, Greg!"
Caligula yelled.
"If you want to keep your tongue, don't tell me how to fight!"
Commodus was still struggling to get up. Caligula stabbed at Frank's chest, but the praetor wasn't there. Instead, a small bird, the common swift, judging from its boomerang-shaped tail, shot straight toward the emperor's face. Frank knew his birds. Swifts aren't large or impressive. They aren't obvious threats like falcons or eagles, but they are incredibly fast and maneuverable. He drove his beak into Caligula's left eye and zoomed away, leaving the emperor shrieking and swatting at the air. Frank materialized in human form right next to me. His eyes looked sunken and glazed. His bad arm hung limp at his side.
"If you really want to help," he said in a low voice, "hobble Commodus. I don't think I can hold them both."
"What?" He transformed back into a swift and was gone, darting at Caligula, who cursed and slashed at the tiny bird. Commodus charged me once more. This time, he was smart enough not to announce himself by howling. By the time I noticed him bearing down on me, blood bubbling from his nostrils, a deep guardrail-shaped groove in his forehead, it was too late. He slammed his fist into my gut, the exact spot I didn't want to be hit. I collapsed in a moaning, boneless heap. Outside, the enemy troops erupted in a fresh round of cheering. Commodus again turned to accept their adulation. I'm ashamed to admit that instead of feeling relieved to have a few extra seconds of life, I was annoyed that he wasn't executing me faster. Every cell in my miserable, mortal body screamed, "Just finish it!" Getting killed could not hurt any worse than the way I already felt. If I died, maybe I'd at least come back as a zombie and get to bite off Commodus's nose. I was now certain Diana wasn't coming to the rescue. Maybe I had messed up the ritual, as Ella feared. Maybe my sister hadn't received the call. Or maybe Jupiter had forbidden her from helping on pain of sharing my mortal punishment. Whatever the case, Frank too must have known our situation was hopeless. We were well past the buying time phase. We were now into the dying as a futile gesture sure is painful phase. My line of vision was reduced to a blurry red cone, but I focused on Commodus's calves as he paced in front of me, thanking his adoring fans. Strapped to the inside of his calf was a sheathed dagger. He had always carried one of those back in the old days. When you're an emperor, the paranoia never stops. You could be assassinated by your housekeeper, your waiter, your launderer, your best friend. And then, despite all your precautions, your godly ex-lover, disguised as your wrestling trainer, ends up drowning you in your bathtub. Surprise!
"Hobble Commodus," Frank had told me.
I had no energy left, but I owed Frank a last request. My body screamed in protest as I stretched out my hand and grabbed the dagger. It slipped easily from its sheath, kept well oiled for a quick draw. Commodus didn't even notice. I stabbed him in the back of the left knee, then the right, before he had even registered the pain. He screamed and toppled forward, spewing Latin obscenities I hadn't heard since the reign of Vespasian. Hobbling accomplished. I dropped the knife,
all my willpower gone. I waited to see what would kill me. The Emperors? The zombie poison? The suspense. I craned my neck to see how my friend, the common swift, was doing. Not well, it turned out. Caligula scored a lucky hit with the flat of his blade, smacking Frank into the wall. The little bird tumbled limply, and Frank shifted back into human form just in time for his face to hit the pavement. Caligula grinned at me. His wounded eye closed tight, his voice filled with hideous glee.
Are you watching, Apollo? You remember what happens next?
He raised his sword over Frank's back.
No!
I screamed. I could not witness another friend's death. Somehow I got to my feet, but I was much too slow. Caligula brought down his blade, which bent in half like a pipe cleaner against Frank's cloak. Thank the gods of military fashion statements. Frank's praetor's cape could turn back weapons, even as its ability to transform into a sweater wrap remained unknown. Caligula snarled in frustration. He drew his dagger, but Frank had recovered enough strength to stand. He slammed Caligula against the wall and wrapped his good hand around the Emperor's throat.
Time's up!
He roared. Time's up? Wait, that was my cue. I was supposed to run, but I couldn't. I stared, frozen in horror, as Caligula buried his dagger in Frank's belly.
Yes, it is, Caligula croaked. For you.
Frank squeezed harder, crushing the Emperor's throat, making Caligula's face turn a bloated purple. Using his wounded arm, which must have been excruciating, Frank pulled the piece of firewood from his pouch.
Frank!
I sobbed. He glanced over, silently ordering me,
go.
I could not bear it. Not again. Not like Jason. I was dimly aware of Commodus struggling to crawl toward me, to grab my ankles. Frank raised his piece of firewood to Caligula's face. The Emperor fought and thrashed, but Frank was stronger, drawing, I suspected, on everything that remained of his mortal life.
If I'm going to burn, he said, I might as well burn bright. This is for Jason.
The firewood spontaneously combusted, as if it had been waiting years for this chance. Caligula's eyes widened with panic, perhaps just now beginning to understand. Flames roared around Frank's body, sparking the oil in one of the grooves on the asphalt. A liquid fuse, racing in both directions, to the crates and traffic barrels that packed the tunnel. The Emperors weren't the only ones who kept a supply of Greek fire. I am not proud of what happened next. As Frank became a column of flame, and the Emperor Caligula disintegrated into white-hot embers, I followed Frank's last order. I leaped over Commodus and ran for open air. At my back, the Caldecott Tunnel erupted like a volcano. Chapter 37. I didn't do it. Explosion? I don't know her. Probably Greg's fault. A third-degree burn was the least painful thing I carried from that tunnel. I staggered into the open, my back sizzling, my hands steaming. Every muscle in my body feeling like it had been scored with razor blades. Before me spread the remaining forces of the Emperors, hundreds of battle-ready warriors. In the distance, stretched across the bay, 50 yachts waited, primed to fire their doomsday artillery.
None of that hurt as much as knowing I had left Frank Zhang in the flames. Caligula was gone. I could feel it. Like the earth heaved a sigh of relief as his consciousness disintegrated in a blast of superheated plasma. But oh, the cost. Frank. Beautiful, awkward, lumbering, brave, strong, sweet, noble Frank. I would have sobbed, but my tear ducts were as dry as Mojave Gulches. The enemy forces looked as stunned as I was. Even the Germani were slack-jawed. It takes a lot to shock an imperial bodyguard. Watching your bosses get blown up in a massive fiery belch from the side of a mountain, that will do it. Behind me, a barely human voice gurgled. I turned. I was too dead inside to feel fear or disgust. Of course Commodus was still alive. He crawled out of the smoke-filled cavern on his elbows, his armor half-melted, his skin coated with ash. His once beautiful face looked like a burnt loaf of tomato bread. I hadn't hobbled him well enough. Somehow I'd missed his ligaments. I'd messed everything up. Even Frank's last request. None of the troops rushed to the Emperor's aid. They remained frozen in disbelief. Perhaps they didn't recognize this wrecked creature as Commodus. Perhaps they thought he was doing another one of his spectacles, and they were waiting for the right moment to applaud. Incredibly, Commodus struggled to his feet. He wobbled like a 1975 Elvis.
Ships!
He croaked. He slurred the words so badly, for a moment I thought he'd yelled something else. I suppose his troops thought the same thing, since they did nothing.
Fire!
Commodus groaned, which again could have simply meant, hey, look, I'm on fire. I only understood his order a heartbeat later, when Gregorix yelled,
signal the yachts!
I choked on my tongue. Commodus gave me a ghastly smile. His eyes glittered with hatred. I don't know where I found the strength, but I charged and tackled him. We hit the asphalt, my legs straddling his chest, my hands wrapped around his throat as they had been thousands of years before, the first time I killed him. This time, I felt no bittersweet regret, no lingering sense of love. Commodus fought, but his fists were like paper. I let loose a guttural roar, a song with only one note, pure rage, and only one volume, maximum. Under the onslaught of sound, Commodus crumbled to ash. My voice faltered. I stared at my empty palms. I stood and backed away, horrified. The charred outline of the Emperor's body remained on the asphalt. I could still feel the pulse of his carotid arteries under my fingers. What had I done? In my thousands of years of life, I'd never destroyed someone with my voice. When I sang, people would often say I killed it, but they never meant that literally. The Emperor's troops stared at me in astonishment. Given another moment, they surely would have attacked, but their attention was diverted by a flare gun going off nearby. A tennis ball-sized globe of orange fire arced into the sky, trailing tang-colored smoke. The troops turned toward the bay, waiting for the fireworks show that would destroy Camp Jupiter. I'll admit, as tired and helpless and emotionally shattered as I was, all I could do was watch too. On 50 aft decks, green dots flickered as the Greek fire charges were uncovered in their mortars. I imagined Pandos technicians scrambling about, inputting their final coordinates. Please, Artemis, I prayed. Now would be a great time to show up. The weapons fired. 50 green fireballs rose into the sky, like emeralds on a floating necklace, illuminating the entire bay. They rose straight upward, struggling to gain altitude. My fear turned to confusion. I knew a few things about flying. You couldn't take off at a 90-degree angle. If I tried that in the Sun Chariot, well, first of all, I would have fallen off and looked really stupid, but also the horses could never have made such a steep climb. They would have toppled into each other and crashed back into the gates of the Sun Palace. You'd have an eastern sunrise, followed immediately by an eastern sunset, and lots of angry whinnying. Why would the mortars be aimed like that? The green fireballs climbed another 50 feet, 100 feet, slowed. On Highway 24, the entire enemy army mimicked their movements, standing up straighter and straighter as the projectiles rose until all the Germani, Cro-Mandi, and other assorted baddies were on their tippy-toes, poised as if levitating. The fireballs stopped and hovered in midair. Then the emeralds fell straight down, right onto the yachts from which they had come. The display of mayhem was worthy of the emperors themselves. 50 yachts exploded in green mushroom clouds, sending confetti of shattered wood, metal, and tiny little flaming monster bodies into the air. Caligula's multi-billion-dollar fleet was reduced to a string of burning oil slicks on the surface of the bay. I may have laughed. I know that was quite insensitive, considering the environmental impact of the disaster. Also terribly inappropriate, given how heartbroken I felt about Frank. But I couldn't help it. The enemy troops turned as one to stare at me. Oh, right, I reminded myself. I am still facing hundreds of hostiles. But they didn't look very hostile. Their expressions were stunned and unsure. I had destroyed Commodus with a shout. I had helped burn Caligula to cinders. Despite my humble appearance, the troops had probably heard rumors that I was once a god. Was it possible they'd be wondering that I had somehow caused the fleet's destruction? In point of fact, I had no idea what had gone wrong with the fleet's weapons. I doubted it was Artemis. It just didn't feel like something she would do. As for Lavinia, I didn't see how she could have pulled off a trick like that with just some fawns, a few dryads, and some chewing gum. I knew it wasn't me. But the army didn't know that. I cobbled together the last shreds of my courage. I channeled my old sense of arrogance from back in the days when I loved to take credit for things I didn't do, as long as they were good and impressive. I gave Gregorix and his army a cruel emperor-like smile. Boo! I shouted. The troops broke and ran. They scattered down the highway in a panic, some leaping straight over the guardrails and into the void just to get away from me faster. Only the poor, tortured Pegasi stayed put, since they had no choice. They were still fastened in their harnesses, the chariot wheels staked to the asphalt to keep the animals from bolting. In any case, I doubted they would have wanted to follow their tormentors. I fell to my knees. My gut wound throbbed. My charred back had gone numb. My heart seemed to be pumping cold, liquid lead. I would be dead soon. Or undead. It hardly mattered. The two emperors were gone. Their fleet was destroyed. Frank was no more. On the bay, the burning oil pools belched columns of smoke that turned orange in the light of the blood moon. It was without a doubt the loveliest trash fire I'd ever beheld. After a moment of shocked silence, the Bay Area Emergency Services seemed to register the new problem. The East Bay had already been deemed a disaster area. With the tunnel closure and the mysterious string of wildfires and explosions in the hills, sirens had been wailing across the flatlands. Emergency lights flickered everywhere on the jammed streets. Now Coast Guard vessels joined the party, cutting across the water to reach the burning oil spills. Police and news helicopters veered toward the scene from a dozen different directions, as if being pulled by a magnet. The mist would be working overtime tonight. I was tempted to just lie down on the road and go to sleep. I knew if I did that, I would die. But at least there would be no more pain. Oh, Frank. And why hadn't Artemis come to help me? I wasn't mad at her. I understood all too well how gods could be, all the different reasons they might not show up when you called. Still, it hurt, being ignored by my own sister. An indignant huff jarred me from my thoughts. The Pegasi were glaring at me. The one on the left had a blind eye, poor thing. But he shook his bridle and made a raspberry kind of sound, as if to say, "Get over yourself, dude." The Pegasus was correct. Other people were hurting. Some of them needed my help. Tarquin was still alive. I could feel it in my zombie-infected blood. Hazel and Meg might well be fighting undead in the streets of New Rome. I wouldn't be much good to them, but I had to try. Either I could die with my friends, or they could cut off my head after I turned into a brain eater, which was what friends were for. I rose and staggered toward the Pegasi. "I'm so sorry this happened to you," I told them. "You are beautiful animals, and you deserve better." One eye grunted as if to say, "You think?" "I'll free you now, if you'll let me." I fumbled with their tack and harness. I found an abandoned dagger on the asphalt and cut away the barbed wire and spiked cuffs that had been digging into the animal's flesh. I carefully avoided their hooves in case they decided I was worth a kick in the head. Then I started humming Dean Martin's "Ain't That a Kick in the Head," because that's just the kind of awful week I was having. "There," I said. When the Pegasi were free, "I have no right to ask anything of you. But if you could see your way to giving me a ride over the hills, my friends are in danger." The Pegasus on the right, who still had both eyes, but whose ears had been cruelly snipped, whinnied an emphatic "No." He trotted toward the College Avenue exit, then stopped halfway and looked back at his friend. One eye grunted and tossed his mane. I imagined his silent exchange with Short Ears went something like this. One eye: "I'm gonna give this pathetic loser a ride. You go ahead, I'll catch up." Short Ears: "You're crazy, man. If he gives you any trouble, kick him in the head." One eye:
"You know I will."
Short Ears trotted off into the night. I couldn't blame him for leaving. I hoped he would find a safe place to rest and heal. One eye nickered at me.
"Well?"
I took one last look at the Caldecott Tunnel, the interior still a maelstrom of green flames. Even without fuel, Greek fire would just keep burning and burning, and that conflagration had been started with Frank's life force, a final thermal burst of heroism that had vaporized Caligula. I didn't pretend to understand what Frank had done or why he had made that choice. But I understood he'd felt it was the only way. He'd burned brightly, all right. The last word Caligula had heard as he got blasted into tiny particles of soot was
Jason.
I stepped closer to the tunnel. I could barely get within 50 feet without the breath being sucked out of my lungs.
Frank!
I yelled.
Frank!
It was hopeless, I knew. There was no way Frank could have survived that. Caligula's immortal body had disintegrated instantly. Frank couldn't have lasted more than a few seconds longer, held together by sheer courage and force of will, just to be sure he took Caligula down with him. I wished I could cry. I vaguely recalled having tear ducts once upon a time. Now all I had was despair, and the knowledge that as long as I wasn't dead, I had to try to help my remaining friends, no matter how much I hurt. I'm so sorry, I said to the flames. The flames didn't answer. They didn't care who or what they destroyed. I fixed my gaze on the crest of the hill. Hazel, Meg, and the last of the 12th Legion were on the other side, fighting off the undead. That's where I needed to be. Okay, I told One Eye. I'm ready.
Chapter 38. Got two words for you. Swiss Army unicorns, man.
Okay, that's four words.
If you ever get the chance to see weaponized unicorns in action, don't. It's something you can't unsee. As we got closer to the city, I detected signs of continuing battle. Columns of smoke, flames licking the tops of buildings, screams, shouts, explosions, you know, the usual. One Eye dropped me at the Pomerian line. He snorted in a tone that said,
"Yeah, good luck with that,"
then galloped away. Pegasi are intelligent creatures. I glanced at Temple Hill, hoping to see storm clouds gathering, or a divine aura of silver light bathing the hillside, or an army of my sister's hunters charging to the rescue. I saw nothing. I wondered if Ella and Tyson were still pacing around the shrine of Diana, checking the fire pit every 30 seconds to see if the Sybil's jelly jar shards were cooked yet. Once again, I had to be a cavalry of one. Sorry, New Rome. I jogged toward the forum, which was where I caught my first glimpse of the unicorns. Definitely not the usual. Meg herself led the charge. She was not riding a unicorn. No one who values their life or their crotch would ever dare ride one. But she did run alongside them, exhorting them to greatness as they galloped into battle. The beasts were outfitted in Kevlar, with their names printed in white block letters along their ribs. Muffin, Buster, Whangdoodle, Shirley, and Horatio, the five unicorns of the apocalypse. Their leather helmets reminded me of those worn by football players in the 1920s. The steed's horns were fitted with specially designed, what would you call them? Attachments? Imagine, if you will, massive conical Swiss Army knives, with various slots from which sprang a convenient variety of destructive implements. Meg and her friends slammed into a horde of Vrakulakai. Former legionnaires killed in Tarquin's previous assault, judging from their grungy bits of armor. A member of Camp Jupiter might have had trouble attacking old comrades, but Meg had no such qualms. Her swords whirled, slicing and dicing and making mounds and mounds of julienned zombies. With a flick of their snouts, her equine friends activated their favorite accessories. A sword blade, a giant razor, a corkscrew, a fork, and a nail file. Buster chose the nail file, which did not surprise me. They plowed through the undead, forking them, corkscrewing them, stabbing them, and nail-filing them into oblivion.
You may wonder why I did not find it horrifying that Meg would use unicorns for war, while I had found it horrifying that the emperors had used Pegasi for their chariot. Setting aside the obvious difference, that the unicorns weren't tortured or maimed, it was clear the one-horned steeds were enjoying themselves immensely. After centuries of being treated as delightful, fanciful creatures who frolicked in meadows and danced through rainbows, these unicorns finally felt seen and appreciated. Meg had recognized their natural talent for kicking undead posterior.
Hey!
Meg grinned when she saw me, like I'd just come back from the bathroom instead of the brink of doomsday.
It's working great. Unicorns are immune to undead scratches and bites.
Shirley huffed, clearly pleased with herself. She showed me her corkscrew attachment, as if to say,
Yeah, that's right. I ain't your rainbow pony. The emperors?
Meg asked me. Dead, but... My voice cracked. Meg studied my face. She knew me well enough. She had been at my side in moments of tragedy. Her expression darkened.
Okay. Grieve later. Right now we should find Hazel. She's...
Meg waved vaguely toward the middle of the town.
Somewhere. So is Tarquin.
Just hearing his name made my gut contort. Why, oh why, couldn't I be a unicorn? We ran with our Swiss army herd up the narrow, winding streets. The battle was mostly pockets of house-to-house combat. Families had barricaded their homes. Shops were boarded up. Archers lurked in upper-story windows, on the lookout for zombies. Roving bands of Uranimoi attacked any living thing they could find. As horrible as the scene was, something about it seemed oddly subdued. Yes, Tarquin had flooded the city with undead. Every sewer grate and manhole cover was open. But he wasn't attacking in force, sweeping systematically through the city to take control. Instead, small groups of undead were popping up everywhere at once, forcing the Romans to scramble and defend the citizenry. It felt less like an invasion and more like a diversion, as if Tarquin himself were after something specific and didn't want to be bothered. Something specific. Like a set of Sibylline books he'd paid good money for back in 530 BCE. My heart pumped more cold lead.
The bookstore. Meg, the bookstore!
She frowned, perhaps wondering why I wanted to shop for books at a time like this. Then realization dawned in her eyes.
Oh.
She picked up speed, running so fast the unicorns had to break into a trot. How I managed to keep up, I don't know. I suppose at that point my body was so far beyond help, it just said, run to death? Yeah, okay, whatever. The fighting intensified as we climbed the hill. We passed part of the fourth cohort battling a dozen slavering ghouls outside a sidewalk cafe. From the windows above, small children and their parents were tossing things at the Uranimoi. Rocks, pots, pans, bottles, while the legionnaires jabbed their spears over the tops of their locked shields. A few blocks farther on, we found Terminus. His World War I greatcoat peppered with shrapnel holes, his nose broken clean off his marble face. Crouching behind his pedestal was a little girl, his helper Julia, I presumed, clutching a steak knife. Terminus turned on us with such fury, I feared he would zap us into stacks of customs declaration forms.
Oh, it's you, he grumbled. My borders have failed. I hope you've brought help.
I looked at the terrified girl behind him, feral and fierce and ready to spring. I wondered who was protecting whom.
Maybe?
The old god's face hardened a bit more, which shouldn't have been possible for stone.
I see. Well, I've concentrated the last bits of my power here, around Julia. They may destroy New Rome, but they will not harm this girl.
Or this statue, said Julia.
My heart turned to Smucker's jelly. We'll win today, I promise. Somehow I made it sound like I actually believed that statement. Where's Hazel?
Over there.
Terminus pointed with his non-existent arms. Based on his glance, I couldn't go by his nose anymore. I assumed he meant to the left. We ran in that direction until we found another cluster of legionnaires.
Where's Hazel?
Meg yelled.
That way,
shouted Layla. 2 blocks, maybe.
Thanks.
Meg sprinted on with her unicorn honor guard, their nail file and corkscrew attachments at the ready. We found Hazel just where Layla had predicted, 2 blocks down, where the street widened into a neighborhood piazza. She and Arion were surrounded by zombies in the middle of the square, outnumbered about 20-1. Arion didn't look particularly alarmed, but he grunted and whinnied in frustration, unable to use his speed in such close quarters. Hazel slashed away with her spatha, while Arion kicked at the mob to keep them back. No doubt Hazel could have handled the situation without help, but our unicorns couldn't resist the opportunity for more zombie posterior kicking. They crashed into the fray, slicing and bottle opening and tweezing the undead in an awesome display of multifunction carnage. Meg leaped into battle, her twin blades spinning. I scanned the street for abandoned projectile weapons. Sadly, they were easy to find. I scooped up a bow and quiver and went to work, giving the zombies some very fashionable skull piercings. When Hazel realized it was us, she laughed with relief, then scanned the area behind me, probably looking for Frank. I met her eyes. I'm afraid my expression told her everything she didn't want to hear. Emotions rippled across her face. Utter disbelief, desolation, then anger. She yelled in rage, spurring Arion, and plowed through the last of the zombie mob. They never had a chance. Once the piazza was secure, Hazel cantered up to me. What happened? Frank. The Emperor's. That's all I could manage. It wasn't much of a narrative, but she seemed to get the gist. She doubled over until her forehead touched Arion's mane. She rocked and murmured, clutching her wrist like a ball player who had just broken her hand and was trying to fight down the pain. At last, she straightened. She took a shaky breath. She dismounted, wrapped her arms around Arion's neck, and whispered something in his ear. The horse nodded. Hazel stepped back and he raced away, a streak of white heading west toward the Caldecott Tunnel. I wanted to warn Hazel there was nothing to find there, but I didn't. I understood heartache a little better now. Each person's grief has its own lifespan. It needs to follow its own path. Where can we find Tarquin? She demanded. What she meant was, who can I kill to make myself feel better? I knew the answer was no one. But again, I didn't argue with her. Like a fool, I led the way to the bookstore to confront the undead king. 2 Urinamoi stood guard at the entrance, which I assumed meant Tarquin was already inside. I prayed Tyson and Ella were still on Temple Hill. With a flick of her hand, Hazel summoned 2 precious stones from the ground. Rubies? Fire opals? They shot past me so fast I couldn't be sure. They hit the ghouls right between the eyes, reducing each guard to a pile of dust. The unicorns looked disappointed. both because they couldn't use their combat utensils, and because they realized we were going through a doorway too small for them to follow.
Go find other enemies, Meg told them. Enjoy.
The five unicorns of the apocalypse happily bucked, then galloped off to do Meg's bidding. I barged into the bookstore, Hazel and Meg at my heels, and waded straight into a crowd of undead. Vrakulakai shuffled through the new release aisle, perhaps looking for the latest in zombie fiction. Others bonked against the shelves of the history section, as if they knew they belonged in the past. One ghoul squatted on a comfy reading chair, drooling as he perused the illustrated book of vultures. Another crouched on the balcony above, happily chewing a leather-bound edition of Great Expectations. Tarquin himself was too busy to notice our entrance. He stood with his back to us, at the information desk, yelling at the bookstore cat.
Answer me, beast! The king screamed. Where are the books?
Aristophanes sat on the desk, one leg straight up in the air, calmly licking his nether regions, which, last I checked, was considered impolite in the presence of royalty.
I will destroy you,
Tarquin said. The cat looked up briefly, hissed, then returned to his personal grooming. Tarquin, leave him alone! I shouted, though the cat seemed to need no help from me. The king turned, and I immediately remembered why I shouldn't be near him. A tidal wave of nausea crashed over me, pushing me to my knees. My veins burned with poison. My flesh seemed to be turning inside out. None of the zombies attacked. They just stared at me with their flat, dead eyes, as if waiting for me to put on my "Hello, my name used to be" name tag and start mingling. Tarquin had accessorized for his big night out. He wore a moldy red cloak over his corroded armor. Gold rings adorned his skeletal fingers. His golden circlet crown looked newly polished, making it clash nicely with his rotted cranium. Tendrils of oily purple neon slithered around his limbs, writhing in and out of his ribcage and circling his neck bones. Since his face was a skull, I couldn't tell if he was smiling, but when he spoke, he sounded pleased to see me.
Well, good. Kill the emperors, did you, my faithful servant? Speak.
I had no desire to tell him anything, but a giant, invisible hand squeezed my diaphragm, forcing out the words.
Dead. They're dead.
I had to bite my tongue to keep from adding Lord.
Excellent, Tarquin said. So many lovely deaths tonight. And the praetor, Frank.
Don't.
Hazel shouldered past me. Tarquin, don't you dare say his name.
Ha! Dead then. Excellent.
Tarquin sniffed the air, purple gas scrolling through his skeletal nose slits.
The city is ripe with fear, agony, loss, wonderful. Apollo, you're mine now, of course. I can feel your heart pumping its last few beats. And Hazel Avesk, I'm afraid you'll have to die for collapsing my throne room on top of me. Very naughty trick. But this McCaffrey child, I'm in such a good mood, I might let her flee for her life and spread word of my great victory. That is, of course, if you cooperate and explain.
He pointed at the cat.
The meaning of this.
It's a cat, I said. So much for Tarquin's good mood. He snarled, and another wave of pain turned my spine to putty. Meg grabbed my arm before my face could hit the carpet.
Leave him alone! She yelled at the king. There's no way I'm fleeing anywhere.
Where are the Sibylline books?
Tarquin demanded.
They are none of these.
He gestured dismissively at the shelves, then glared at Aristophanes.
And this creature will not speak. The harpy and the cyclops who were rewriting the prophecies. I can smell that they were here, but they are gone. Where are they?
I said a silent prayer of thanks for stubborn harpies. Ella and Tyson must have still been waiting at Temple Hill for divine help that wasn't coming. Meg snorted.
You're stupid for a king. The books aren't here. They're not even books.
Tarquin regarded my small master, then turned to his zombies.
What language is she speaking? Did that make sense to anyone?
The zombies stared at him unhelpfully. The ghouls were too busy reading about vultures and eating Great Expectations. Tarquin faced me again.
What does the girl mean? Where are the books, and how are they not books?
Again, my chest constricted. The words burst out of me. Tyson! Cyclops! Prophecies tattooed on his skin! He's on Temple Hill with...
Quiet!
Meg ordered. My mouth clamped shut, but it was too late. The words were out of the barn. Was that the right expression? Tarquin tilted his skull.
The chair in the back room. Yes, yes, I see now. Ingenious. I will have to keep this harpy alive and watch her practice her art. Prophecies on flesh. Oh, I can work with that.
You'll never leave this place, Hazel growled. My troops are cleaning up the last of your invaders. It's just us now, and you're about to rest in pieces. Tarquin hissed a laugh.
Oh, my dear. Did you think that was the invasion? Those troops were just my skirmishers, tasked with keeping you all divided and confused while I came here to secure the books. Now I know where they are, which means the city can be properly pillaged. The rest of my army should be coming through your sewers right about.
He snapped his bone fingers.
Now.
Chapter 39. Captain Underpants does not appear in this book. Copyright issues. I waited for the sounds of renewed combat outside. The bookstore was so quiet, I could almost hear the zombies breathing. The city remained silent.
Right about now,
Tarquin repeated, snapping his finger bones again.
Having communications issues? Hazel asked.
Tarquin hissed.
What have you done?
Me? Nothing yet.
Hazel drew her spatha. That's about to change. Aristophanes struck first. Of course the cat would make the fight all about him. With an outraged mule and no apparent provocation, the giant orange tub of fur launched himself at Tarquin's face, fastening his foreclaws on the skull's eye sockets and kicking his back feet against Tarquin's rotten teeth. The king staggered under this surprise assault, screaming in Latin, his words garbled because of the cat paws in his mouth. And so, the battle of the bookstore began. Hazel launched herself at Tarquin. Meg seemed to accept that Hazel had first dibs on the big baddie,
considering what had happened to Frank. So she concentrated on the zombies instead, using her double blades to stab and hack and push them toward the non-fiction section. I drew an arrow, intending to shoot the ghoul on the balcony, but my hands trembled too badly. I couldn't get to my feet. My eyesight was dim and red. On top of all that, I realized I'd drawn the only arrow remaining in my original quiver, the arrow of Dodona.
"Heardest thou on, Apollo?"
the arrow said in my mind.
"Yieldeth thyself not to the undead king?"
Through my fog of pain, I wondered if I was going crazy. "Are you giving me a pep talk?" The idea made me giggle. "Phew, I'm tired." I collapsed on my butt. Meg stepped over me and slashed a zombie who had been about to eat my face. "Thank you," I muttered, but she'd already moved on. The ghouls had reluctantly put down their books and were now closing in on her. Hazel stabbed at Tarquin, who had just flung Aristophanes off his face. The cat yowled as he flew across the room. He managed to catch the edge of a bookshelf and scramble to the top. He glared down at me with his yellow eyes, his expression implying, "I meant to do that." The arrow of Dodona kept talking in my head.
"Thou hast done well, Apollo. Thou hast only one job now. Live!"
"That's a really hard job," I muttered. "I hate my job."
"Thou hast only to wait. Hold on."
"Wait for what?" I murmured. "Hold on to what? Oh, I guess I'm holding on to you."
"Yes," the arrow said. "Yes. Doest thou that? Stayest thou with me, Apollo? Darest thou not die upon me, man?"
"Isn't that from a movie?" I asked. "Like every movie?" "Wait, you actually care if I die?"
"Apollo!" yelled Meg, slashing at Great Expectations. "If you're not going to help, could you at least crawl someplace safer?"
I wanted to oblige. I really did. But my legs wouldn't work. "Oh, look," I muttered to no one in particular. "My ankles are turning gray. Oh, wow, my hands are too."
"No," said the arrow. "Hold on."
"For what?"
"Concentrate upon my voice. Let us sing a song. Thou likest songs, dost thou not?"
"Sweet Caroline," I warbled.
"Perhaps a different song."
"Bam, bam, bam," I continued.
The arrow relented and began singing along with me, though he lagged behind, since he had to translate all the lyrics into Shakespearean language. This was how I would die. Sitting on the floor of a bookstore, turning into a zombie while holding a talking arrow and singing Neil Diamond's greatest hit. Even the fates cannot foresee all the wonders the universe has in store for us. At last, my voice dried up. My vision tunneled. The sounds of combat seemed to reach my ears from the ends of long metal tubes. Meg slashed through the last of Tarquin's minions. That was a good thing, I thought distantly. I didn't want her to die too. Hazel stabbed Tarquin in the chest. The Roman king fell, howling in pain, ripping the sword hilt from Hazel's grip. He collapsed against the information desk, clutching the blade with his skeletal hands. Hazel stepped back, waiting for the zombie king to dissolve. Instead, Tarquin struggled to his feet, purple gas flickering weakly in his eye sockets.
"I have lived for millennia," he snarled. "You could not kill me with 1,000 tons of stone, Hazel Levesque. You will not kill me with a sword."
I thought Hazel might fly at him and rip his skull off with her bare hands. Her rage was so palpable, I could smell it like an approaching storm. Wait. I did smell an approaching storm. Along with other forest scents. Pine needles. Morning dew on wildflowers. The breath of hunting dogs. A large silver wolf licked my face. Lupa? A hallucination? No. A whole pack of the beasts had trotted into the store and were now sniffing the bookshelves and the piles of zombie dust. Behind them, in the doorway, stood a girl who looked about 12. Her eyes silver yellow. Her auburn hair pulled back in a ponytail. She was dressed for the hunt in a shimmering gray frock and leggings, a white bow in her hand. Her face was beautiful, serene and as cold as the winter moon. She knocked a silver arrow and met Hazel's eyes, asking permission to finish her kill. Hazel nodded and stepped aside. The young girl aimed at Tarquin. "Foul, undead thing," she said, her voice hard and bright with power. "When a good woman puts you down, you had best stay down." Her arrow lodged in the center of Tarquin's forehead, splitting his frontal bone. The king stiffened. The tendrils of purple gas sputtered and dissipated. From the arrow's point of entry, a ripple of fire the color of Christmas tinsel spread across Tarquin's skull and down his body, disintegrating him utterly. His gold crown, the silver arrow, and Hazel's sword all dropped to the floor. I grinned at the newcomer. "Hey, sis." Then I keeled over sideways. The world turned fluffy, bleached of all color. Nothing hurt anymore. I was dimly aware of Diana's face hovering over me, Meg and Hazel peering over the goddess's shoulders. "He's almost gone," Diana said. Then I was gone. My mind slipped into a pool of cold, slimy darkness. "Oh, no, you don't." My sister's voice woke me rudely. I'd been so comfortable, so non-existent. Life surged back into me, cold, sharp, and unfairly painful. Diana's face came into focus. She looked annoyed, which seemed on brand for her. As for me, I felt surprisingly good. The pain in my gut was gone. My muscles didn't burn. I could breathe without difficulty. I must have slept for decades. "How long was I out?" I croaked. "Roughly 3 seconds," she said. "Now get up, drama queen." She helped me to my feet. I felt a bit unsteady, but I was delighted to find that my legs had any strength at all. My skin was no longer gray. The lines of infection were gone. The arrow of Dodona was still in my hand, though he had gone silent, perhaps in awe of the goddess's presence. Or perhaps he was still trying to get the taste of sweet Caroline out of his imaginary mouth. Meg and Hazel stood nearby, bedraggled but unharmed. Friendly gray wolves milled around them, bumping against their legs and sniffing their shoes, which had obviously been to many interesting places over the course of the day. Aristophanes regarded us all from his perch atop the bookshelf, decided he didn't care, then went back to cleaning himself. I beamed at my sister. It was so good to see her disapproving, "I can't believe you're my brother," frown again. "I love you," I said, my voice hoarse with emotion. She blinked, clearly unsure what to do with this information. "You really have changed." "I missed you." "Yes, well, I'm here now. Even Dad couldn't argue with a Sibylline invocation from Temple Hill. It worked then! I grinned at Hazel and Meg. It worked!
Yeah, Meg said wearily. Hi, Artemis.
Diana, my sister corrected. But hello, Meg. For her, my sister had a smile. You've done well, young warrior. Meg blushed. She kicked at the scattered zombie dust on the floor and shrugged.
Eh.
I checked my stomach, which was easy since my shirt was in tatters. The bandages had vanished, along with the festering wound. Only a thin, white scar remained. So, I'm healed? My flab told me she hadn't restored me to my godly self. Nah, that would have been too much to expect. Diana raised an eyebrow. Well, I'm not the goddess of healing, but I'm still a goddess. I think I can take care of my little brother's boo-boos.
Little brother?
She smirked, then turned to Hazel. And you, Centurion, how have you been? Hazel was no doubt sore and stiff, but she knelt and bowed her head like a good Roman. She hesitated. Her world had just been shattered. She'd lost Frank. She apparently decided not to lie to the goddess. I'm heartbroken and exhausted, my lady. But thank you for coming to our aid. Diana's expression softened. Yes, I know it has been a difficult night. Come, let's go outside. It's rather stuffy in here, and it smells like burnt cyclops. The survivors were slowly gathering on the street. Perhaps some instinct had drawn them there, to the place of Tarquin's defeat. Or perhaps they'd simply come to gawk at the glowing silver chariot, with its team of four golden reindeer now parallel parked in front of the bookshop. Giant eagles and hunting falcons shared the rooftops. Wolves hobnobbed with Hannibal the elephant and the weaponized unicorns. Legionnaires and citizens of New Rome milled about in shock. At the end of the street, huddled with a group of survivors, was Thalia Grace. Her hand on the shoulder of the Legion's new standard bearer, comforting the young woman as she cried. Thalia was dressed in her usual black denim, various punk band buttons gleaming on the lapel of her leather jacket. A silver circlet, the symbol of Artemis's lieutenant, glinted in her spiky dark hair. Her sunken eyes and slumped shoulders made me suspect that she already knew about Jason's death. Perhaps had known for a while, and had gone through a first hard wave of grieving. I winced with guilt. I should have been the one to deliver the news about Jason. The cowardly part of me felt relieved that I didn't have to bear the initial brunt of Thalia's anger. The rest of me felt horrible that I felt relieved. I needed to go talk to her. Then something caught my eye in the crowd, checking out Diana's chariot. People were packed into its carriage tighter than New Year's Eve revelers in a stretch limo's sunroof. Among them was a lanky young woman with pink hair. From my mouth escaped another completely inappropriate, delighted laugh. Lavinia? She looked over and grinned. This ride is so cool. I never want to get out. Diana smiled. Well, Lavinia Asimov, if you want to stay on board, you'd have to become a hunter. Nope. Lavinia hopped off as if the chariot's floorboards had become lava. No offense, my lady, but I like girls too much to take that vow. Like them. Not just like them, like... I understand. Diana sighed. Romantic love. It's a plague. Lavinia, how did you... I stammered. Where did you... This young woman,
said Diana, was responsible for the destruction of the Triumvirate's fleet.
Well, I had a lot of help, Lavinia said.
Peaches,
said a muffled voice from somewhere in the chariot. He was so short, I hadn't noticed him before. Hidden as he was behind the carriage's sideboard and the crowd of big folk. But now Peaches squirmed and climbed his way to the top of the railing. He grinned his wicked grin. His diapers sagged. His leafy wings rustled. He beat his chest with his minuscule fists and looked very pleased with himself.
Peaches!
Meg cried.
Peaches!
Peaches agreed, and he flew into Meg's arms. Never had there been such a bittersweet reunion between a girl and her deciduous fruit spirit. There were tears and laughter, hugs and scratches, and cries of Peaches in every tone from scolding to apologetic to jubilant. I don't understand, I said, turning to Lavinia. You made all those mortars malfunction? Lavinia looked offended.
Well, yeah. Somebody had to stop the fleet. I did pay attention during siege weapon class and shipboarding class. It wasn't that hard. All it took was a little fancy footwork.
Hazel finally managed to pick her jaw off the pavement. Wasn't that hard?
We were motivated.
The fauns and dryads did great. She paused, her expression momentarily clouding, as if she remembered something unpleasant.
Besides, the nereids helped a lot. There was only a skeleton crew aboard each yacht. Not like actual skeletons, but you know what I mean.